your hearing, and thank you all again.
Okay. Well, thank you for arranging, Malky. I'm very excited to be learning with everybody. Anyone who is comfortable with turning on their camera, it definitely feels more interactive that way, and it'll be easier for me. And if you want to ask questions, feel free to just ask. You can put it in the chat. I'll check the chat periodically, but if you just sort of call out, then that'll be easier, and I'll hear you. Oh, now I'm host, so I have to admit people. Oh, that's fine. Okay. As people come in, I'll just be admitting them into the room. Okay. Well, really, thank you, Malky, for arranging. The plan for the next few weeks is to discuss issues of halachic process. We have not yet finalized on all the topics. Malky and I have gone back and forth, but I wanted to leave it open until I got a chance to meet you and to learn with you a little bit, and then we can take the topics that emerge really from our conversations and take it in the direction that you want. To start off, I figured that we would do it's a little bit ambitious for one class, but try to do an introduction to the halachic process, to psak, to halachic rulings, to try to get an idea of how many topics and how complex this really is. So I don't know if Malky passed around the source sheets already, but I'll share them on my screen. Can I share documents? Probably. But I'll share them on my screen, and I can send them afterwards. And as anyone who's learned with me before knows, I'm more than happy for you to follow up after the class as well. My email is on the top of the source sheets. I'll put it in the chat. One second here. Okay. And you know what? I can. Yeah, here, I'll share the source sheets also in the chat now. Here we go. For some reason it is not letting me share them. Okay. Okay, let me share one. Let's see if we can get two. Yeah, there we go. So I shared it in, but really we're going to really organize it. We're going to work off of a graphic I put together to really summarize why I think that psak is so complex and to understand just how many topics really emerge from it. So if you look at is the graphic on the screen now? Okay, great. So, if I asked you what factors go into making a halachic decision, right? You imagine for a moment you are a posek, you're a halachic authority. So what do you think, right? What factors even go into it? Where do you start? What do you do? You can look at the graphic, but before you even look at the graphic, right? Where do you think you start? What factors do you start looking at? Someone's gonna have to break the ice. Yeah.
Shulchan Aruch.
Okay, so let's analyze that. So Shulchan Aruch. So what do you mean by Shulchan Aruch? Why would you look at Shulchan Aruch first?
Because that's where all the list of, if I just be crude, a list of all of the halachos that's found in the Gemara.
Okay, so what Malky says is look at Shulchan Aruch because it's a list of all the halachot found in the Gemara. So If we tease that out for a second, implicit in what Malky is saying is that really the first place she would go is the Gemara, right? Shulchan Aruch is like a way to figure out how to get to the Gemara because maybe not all of us know all of Shas and have it at our fingertips. But in the background, Malky is thinking, the first place I go is the Gemara. I don't necessarily know how to get to the right passage in the Gemara, So Shulchan Aruch is a good place to get there. But Malki's intuition is that the first place we go is the Gemara. Okay, good. Why? Right? Why? Let's push that farther. Why do we go to the Gemara? Why does that matter?
It's the earliest source of any type of halakha.
Okay, good. So, and if I will just, I have your names as it appears in the Zoom, but if you want to be called something else, let me know. But Stephen says, because it's the first source we have, right? This is like our earliest source of halachic literature. I mean, mostly, not exactly, but yeah, meaning the Gemara elaborates on the Tanaitic material, so the Mishnah and the Midrash Halacha, so the Sifra and the Sifrei and the Mechilta. But the Gemara is an analysis of that. But it's one of the earlier sources. Okay, so Stephen, what about the Psukim, right? Why not Chumash then?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a good answer. It's a good question.
Okay, good, right? So Stephen says the earliest source. So again, so let me tease out what Stephen's thinking, but then let's push it. So both Malki and Stephen fundamentally think we're looking at the Gemara. The reason they want to look at the Gemara, one second, someone else is coming into the room, is because it's an early source. Now, okay, why is early important? Right? Let's push it. Why early? Why is that like a magic word? Right? Meaning if I asked, let's say I asked a scientific question, right? I said, you're a doctor and you want to treat cancer, right? So by that logic, if early is good, you'd say, aha, I know how to solve cancer. I will go back to Galen. And Galen said, cancer is a function of black bile. So all we need to do is to figure out how to solve the black bile problem, and we have solved cancer, right? But we don't do that. We go to the latest sources, right? Because when it comes to medicine, we think that the newest sources are better. So here we're making an assumption. Now, when it comes to halacha, we go to the earliest sources, but why? It's a good assumption, but why? And I don't know how often we think about why, right? Why do we go to the earliest sources?
Well, because that's closest to what Hashem gave us at Har Sinai, and or Moshe, Hashem gave us at Har Sinai, and then Moshe taught us in the desert, perhaps?
Okay, good, right? Very good. Right? So I think that Malki has it right on the head. That, right, obviously Torah is different than science, than medicine, right? We're assuming that there is a body of knowledge that at some point originated from a authoritative source. God. God gives it to Moshe, right? We think here the first Mishnah in Avot. So, Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, misara liYoshua, Yoshua is Kenim, Kenim leNeviim, Neviim misaru al Anshei Knesset Agdolah. Right, so it goes Hashem, Moshe, ... Anshei Knesset Agdolah, then transitions into the Tanaim and the Mishnah. That's elaborated on in the Gemara, and we're trying to recreate. Right, we're trying to recreate that chain, rediscover that chain. Now, all of these comments, I think, come back to factor one in Psak, which what I call here, right, the little bit of a mouthful, but I'll explain what I mean here, is the independent analysis of canonical sources. Okay, that's a very complicated way of saying, right, that there's an idea of canon. Canon meaning the texts, traditions that make up the fundamental intrinsic authority of our religious worldview, right? The first factor that anyone needs to figure out how do we formulate a halachic decision is to figure out, well, what do the sources that have their own authority, what do they say, right? What are the sources that have their own authority, that I care about what they say because they are intrinsically important, because they represent a fundamental truth about our tradition. What do they say? Right? And that's a very intuitive place to start. But it's a very complicated place to start, because writ large, we can all agree that a religion, which is based on a God-given Torah, needs to go back to the original sources because it needs to figure out what God wanted. That's pretty intuitive. But, well, what counts, right? Both Malki and Stephen jumped to the Gemara. Now, by the Gemara, they probably meant Bavli, right? They probably meant Bavli. I can't speak for them, but probably they meant the Bavli. But then we've got to ask, is that true? Did they mean the Bavli? Do you mean the Bavli? What about the Yerushalmi? Does the Yerushalmi, is it part of our Psak? And you could ask that in one of two ways. One is, does the Yerushalmi have weight if it contradicts the Bavli? And even if it doesn't, even if when there's a battle between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, we'll rule like the Bavli, well, what if the Bavli is silent? Is the Yerushalmi not important for Psak? Or is it important for Psak if the Bavli is silent? And why is the Bavli where we turn to begin with? Right? If it's where we turn. And what about the Mishnah? Why are we jumping to the Bavli? Why the Mishnah? And why is the Mishnah considered canonical? Okay, because it reflects the traditions given from Moshe, etc. Okay, but there are disputes in the Mishnah. There are texts outside the Mishnah from the same period. Tosefta, Sifra, Sifrei, Mechilta, the Midrash Halacha. Are those authoritative? If they are, in what way? As I mentioned to Stephen, we're jumping here to Bavli, to Talmud, to Mishnah. But what about Tanakh? Meaning, sure, the Gemara is analyzing what God said in the Chumash. Maybe Tanakh, right? Maybe just Chumash, meaning just the five books of Moses, or maybe the whole Nach, including the 24 books. Maybe yes, maybe no, I don't know, right? Do we turn to the Tanakh directly? Or maybe only mediated through the lens of Chazal? And then here I threw in a lot of other questions that come under this. So, for example, what is the role of Kabbalah, the mystical Jewish mystical tradition, in Psak? Okay? So, in traditional Kabbalistic circles, the Zohar is dated to the Tannaitic period. Right? It's dated to the Tannaitic period. Meaning, Rav Shimon bar Yochai is the attributed author, and he is a same generation as the Mishnah. Now, even if we assume...
I was going to say, can you just... The Tannaitic period, I just want to make sure, is that's the first one. That's the Mishnah.
Yeah, so, right, so let's do a quick scheme. If I have to, I'll pull up, find the other source and pull it up. But, right, if we're talking, right, let's say the Torah is given about 3,500 years ago, or a little less, right, 30, let's say, use the traditional years based on Midrash Seder Olam Rabbah. So let's say, according to that number, Kabbalat HaTorah, let's see, Yetziat Mitzrayim is 3,333 years ago, okay? So Kabbalat HaTorah is that year, right? So you have whatever happens from that. The Mishnah is written about the second century, right? Second century of the Common Era, so, right, about 1,900 years ago, 1,800 years ago or so. So there's all those traditions that are floating around that we got to figure out what's happening from 3,300 years ago to about 1,800 years ago. But the Mishnah is second century, let's say second to fourth century, right? The Tannaitic material, Mishnah, Tosefta, Midrash, Halacha. Yeah. So traditional Kabbalists will tell you that the paradigmatic Kabbalistic text, the Zohar, is written by Rav Shimon bar Yochai, who's a member of the same period of the Mishnah, second to fourth century. Okay, let's assume that that's true for the moment, though that's called into dispute not just by academics, but by traditional Jewish thinkers as well. But let's assume that that's the case. So, is it part of the halachic canon? On the one hand, maybe it comes from that period, so maybe it should have weight similar to the Mishnah. On the other hand, when you're in the when you have a dispute in the Mishnah between the said author of the Zohar, Rav Shimon bar Yochai, and other Tanaim, in general, we rule against Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. So it's a text that, even if it comes from the Tannaitic period, comes from an authority who, when he is in other rabbinic texts, is usually rejected. So what do we do when he's found in a text without those other voices? Right? So this gets complicated, right? Even if we all agree that the first place you go is the original canonical early sources to best, let's say, recover the material from God, what texts even get into that thing? Mishnah, Bavli, Yerushalmi, Kabbalah, and even within the Gemara, let's say. Okay, the Gemara is divided, broadly speaking, into halachic, strictly halachic material, and not obviously halachic material, agadic material, which includes philosophy, and includes stories, and ethics, and things like that. Is agadic material halachically binding? If it is, in what way? Does it depend on whether it's a story, whether it's a philosophical statement? Meaning, even within the Bavli, what parts of it are authoritative? All of it? Some of it? Some more than others? So, here.
Isn't there a cloud that we don't pass in from the Gemara?
From the?
Gemara.
From the Gemara. So Jeff says, don't we not paskin from the Gemara? Well, yes and no, right? Meaning the Gemara itself says, don't paskin from the Gemara, right? I'm doing this with my students today. I did this with my students this morning. My time. Middle of the night, your time, right? But yes, the Gemara in Bava Batra Kuf Lamed says, we do not rule from the Gemara. At which point the Rashbam jumps in and says, but we do paskin from the Gemara. So what does that mean? And then he sort of jumps through hoops to figure out why what the Gemara means by Gemara is not what we mean by Gemara. Which, if that sounds complicated, that is confusing. But yes, the Gemara's rule that we don't rule by the Gemara doesn't apply to itself. Right? It means something else by the word Gemara than we do. So Jeff is right. Maybe we're just wrong. Maybe passing into the Gemara is a mistake because Gemara says not to do that. The majority view is that we do paskin from our Gemara, but in order to get to that point, they have to reinterpret that line, right? Which says, don't do that. But yes, you're 100% right, right? This is all complicated by the fact that at least a simple read of the Gemara says this is all wrong, right? Which is, ein lemeidin mipi ha-Gemara. So, yes. And that's why I broadened it here, and I didn't put Gemara. I said, independent analysis, meaning the posek, who's now trying to figure out halacha, independent analysis. What does he or she think of canonical sources? Of whatever sources you think get first level primacy. Whatever that is. But as I note here in the small print, and the question just raised, we can all, broadly speaking, agree that that's an important place to start. But what even counts in that category? Well, right, it took us 18 minutes just to sort of touch on the surface of what that might even mean. But okay, factor one. Great, we're one factor down. What's the next thing you would do? Yes, who's talking?
Martin.
Yes, go, Martin. Shoot.
Yeah, is there a thought that Torah predates creation? And if that thought is a thought that I heard expressed, in other words, the blueprint for the world, if that's true, then does that impact our discussion about halacha? And does that impact our discussion about what our primary source is?
Possibly, yes. Meaning the Midrashic, and especially Kabbalistic, though it appears in non-Kabbalistic sources, but in Kabbalah it's a very important idea, but in Midrashic sources it's important as well, that the Torah is there's like a primordial Torah from which God creates the world. Histakel be oraita ubara alma. And therefore, there's a certain idea of Torah that's sort of, I don't even know how to say this, but written into the fabric of the world. So for some, this explains the challenging idea presented in several places in the Gemara that the Avot kept the Torah before the Torah was given. Because in some way, it is tapped into, right, where they tapped into the reality of the world. Now, what about Psak? So, I would say it has less resonance in practical Psak, but not none. Meaning, sometimes you'll see people writing about, well, maybe natural morality, or things that seem to emerge from what just has to be by looking at the world, maybe that has weight. Well, maybe it does, because if the world itself reflects some primordial Torah, so maybe it's also a data point, right? And you have Gemaras like this. The Gemara has a surprising comment in Erevin that if the Torah had not been given, so then we still could have derived certain laws or principles from looking at the cat and looking at the ant, right? And it has a list of different ethical principles you could tease out of them. So there is this hint at an idea that maybe the fact that the Torah is built into the fabric of the world means there's Torah-y sources, right, floating around that are not actually written. Christine Hayes devotes some time to this in her book, What's Divine About Divine Law, pointing out that this does affect how these traditions do affect how early Jewish thinkers, meaning contemporaneous with Chazal, are thinking about halacha. So it definitely might have a factor, right? Exactly how is messy, but might. Okay, so now let's go to factor two. So Malki had said, go to Shulchan Aruch. And when I pressed her, Malki had said, Shulchan Aruch, because Shulchan Aruch will tell me what the Gemara says. But there's really another reason why you might have looked at Shulchan Aruch, which has, right? Why else might someone look at Shulchan Aruch if it's not just to figure out what the Gemara said?
Does it give you all the sources from where the Gemara said and like what their thought process is or where their sources are that they made that decision?
Whose sources?
I guess the Bei Yosef, who I guess wrote where the Shulchan Aruch is taken from, is obviously a lot larger than the Shulchan Aruch.
Very good. So Malki says, well, Shulchan Aruch is really a shorthand. What we mean is Shulchan Aruch is the summary of what the Beit Yosef wrote. Now, what's the Beit Yosef? So, 16th century, Rabbi Yosef Karo writes an encyclopedic work summarizing, as he sees it, all post-Talmudic sources and how they get from the Gemara to their ruling, and summarizes everything. And then the summary of it is Shulchan Aruch. Very good. Now, implicit in what Malki just said is factor number two, which is after we figure out what Gemaras we're looking at or what primary sources we're looking at, the next factor that a posek wants to do, unless he or she wants to embark on, you know, a solo journey into the halachic process, right, is to figure out what have other people said about those canonical sources. Meaning, I can't think of every single possibility of how to understand every passage in the Gemara. I care about how those primary sources have been interpreted through the generations. Right? That's what we call precedent. Meaning, what have other authorities before me said? Right? And I think that's the second factor that any posek cares about, right? First thing is, what do I personally think the primary sources, whatever I think they are, what do I think they said? Step two, what did everybody else in the history of our tradition? Yes, Malki.
So, to the history of the tradition when you talk about everyone else. Is the Gemara the first known, or do, or are there things in, let's say, Navi or the Torah that would give us a clue also? Is that also precedent? I mean, does it just start with the Gemara, or does
if I blow this up for a second, right, I put here in the independent analysis, canonical sources, here, my sub-question two is Tanakh still used to determine halakha, right? Meaning, even if we agree in principle that the first step is to find the primary sources, we got to figure out what we consider primary. And maybe it's the Gemara, or maybe it's the Torah, we can still derive halakha directly, right? Or maybe not. But even after we solved all those problems, we move to the second, which is, okay, whatever we think the precedent is, right? Oop, too big. Whatever we think the precedent, whatever we think that says, now I gotta figure out, what did everybody else say, right? The Rambam, the Rush, I don't know, all the people, meaning once we figure out how to arbitrarily draw the line between primary sources, right? Canonical sources, the sources that everyone has to answer to, right? Whatever that is, the Gemara, the Mishnah, the Chumash, the Navi, whatever you want to put in that category, the next step is to figure out, well, what did everybody say about those sources, right? Because I don't do this by myself, right? I'm part of a living tradition. And whenever we divided between primary and secondary sources, wherever we draw that line, now I want to know, well, what did everybody in the secondary source period think about those sources? Because I care, right? I'm part of a tradition. I care about what other people thought. I don't want to do this by myself. But that's also a complicated question. Because, okay, well, what? That's very nice. I care about what other people said. Wonderful. And now what? Who counts? Do only the Rishonim, the medieval commentators, count? The modern commentators? Which one is more important? Is it the earlier you go, the more important, or the later you go, more important because it reflects consensus? Do I have to care about specifically authorities that are from my tradition? Ashkenazi? Svardi? Am I allowed to look at people from other traditions? Is there such a thing, as Malki knows from my course at Drisha, is there such a thing as Ashkenazi or Svardi in the modern period? Meaning, and even if I have all these authorities in front of me, I'm Rav Avadya Yosef, I know everything, right? You know, right after he died, his son came and gave a eulogy at, I was in Gush at the time, and he said they counted his father's library when he passed away, it had 40,000 books. So even if he knew all 40,000 by heart, now what? Do you count them and go by the majority? Do you try to figure out who was smarter and balance based on intellect, on wisdom? I mean, like, even if I care about what people before me said, whose opinion do I care about? Why? How much? How do I weigh it? So that's factor two, precedent. Okay? Third category is custom, right? So again, first is whatever I define as the primary sources, what do I think they say? Two, whoever I think count as the good interpreters of said tradition, what have they said and how do I weigh what they said in making my decision? Factor three, custom. Custom. Now, what does custom mean? It means a lot of things, right? There are customs of places. There are customs of communities. There are customs of families. Or all of those created equal, right? There are customs which are not based in halacha, right? They're merely, quote-unquote, customs, like Kabbalat Shabbat, let's say, that everyone agrees is just a custom, right? There's no obligation in a halachic sense. It's a custom. It gets its authority because it's a custom. And then there are customs to follow certain halachic positions, which is some sort of mix of custom and precedent, right? Like, I am in Ashkenazi, so I have the custom to follow the Rama, right? That's like some sort of mix and match of custom and halachic ruling. And then there's something which Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik calls minhag versus nohag. There's nohag is what people do, regardless of whether it has anything to do with halacha, right? Just what I see. And minhag are like formalized practices. Which types of customs count? Those that have some formal backing? Or does the very fact that people do something, does that give it authority? Okay? Now, let's say I take these three factors and somehow I balance them, and every posek has a different weight. I think every posek in the world cares about these three factors, but in different ways, right? Someone like Rabbi Ovadia Yosef cared mostly about precedent. You read his tshuvot, he just lists 10,000 people and comes up, theoretically, with a majority. Certain poskim cared about their own analysis of the Gemara. People like Rav Moshe Feinstein. You read Rav Moshe Feinstein, he quotes minimal sources. He quotes like the Gemara and the few Rishonim, Shulchan Aruch maybe, that he makes to prove his point, and a whole lot of creativity, right? But he very heavily weighs his own analysis of the primary sources. And then you have poskim who care about custom a lot. As an example, let's say Hasidish poskim. Hasidish poskim, right? Mostly, if you tell them, do you sit in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeret, they will say, I don't care that it says in the Gemara that you sit in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeret, I don't care that it says it in the Rambam and the Tor and the Shulchan Aruch. The custom has been in our community for 200 years that we don't sit in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeret. Don't tell me you do, right? Like, this is how, like, poskim like Rav Gavriel Zinner, the Nitei Gavriel, write. Meaning, I don't care. If this is the custom, then it's right. We'll go backwards and justify it in the sources, but custom rules. Okay? Now, this is a little bit simplistic because every posek has their breaking point where one of these factors will override the others, even if they have a preferred factor that they normally turn to, but okay, fine. Now, all of this taken together gets you to what I call... Yes, Malki, go.
But all of them are right in their, you know, they're not obviously wrong. No one was ever, chas v'shalom, going to call any of those Rebbeim wrong for making their socks the way they do. So they all have their right, okay.
Right, meaning these are not, right, this is not like, it's as the Ramban says in his introduction to the Milchamot, halacha is not like math. Right? Halacha isn't right or wrong. It's a game of plausibility. Right? It's an art of plausibility. Meaning, no argument is 100% right and compelling. Arguments are more compelling or less compelling. And certain poskim are more compelled by one of these factors, but all poskim are some way weighing a little bit of each of these factors to come up with what they think is the most plausible psak. Now, why do I say the most plausible psak and not the psak, right? Meaning, we've already complicated things, so why don't I just say, okay, we have, in whatever way that you balance these factors, you've now added together the way you understand the Gemara, you've read all the sources you think are relevant, interpreting the Gemara and weigh them however you think proper, you've balanced the existing practice in the community, mix them all together, and come up with what you think the most plausible answer is. Okay, so why are we not done? Why are we not at a psak? Well, the reason we're not at a psak is for two reasons. One, let's say this is a normal case, okay? A normal case. Okay, great. So in a normal case, given, once I have gone through the very complex process of weighing how much authority I give to precedent and to the Gemara and all other authoritative primary sources and custom, so I know that if the situation is X, then the psak is Y. But that is a lot easier said than done. Because you've got to figure out whether the case in question is in fact X. Right? Meaning, right? Very simply. We all agree, we all know this. If someone's life is in danger on Shabbat, you can violate Shabbat to save their lives. In order to invoke that halachic reality, you must establish as a fact on the ground that their life is in danger. But that means that in addition to the halachic analysis, there's an empirical analysis of reality that must go on for theoretical halacha to become psak. And that's not easy. Now, why is that not easy? So, for a lot of reasons. One, reality is almost always messy. That should be obvious. But okay, reality is messy. But it's not just that. If, let's take a medical question, right? If someone's life is in danger, then they can violate Shabbat. They can eat on Yom Kippur, etc. Okay. How does a halachic authority go about figuring out the reality on the ground? Right. What do they do? I don't know. Do they? Because there's a lot of possibilities here. They could say, I'm a rabbi, I'm not a doctor. So they could tell the patient, go ask your own doctor. That's one possibility. But in that case, the posek is saying, as a philosophical statement, that the job of a halachic authority is to determine the halacha, but determining reality is not their job at all. Right? Their job is to say, if X, if your life is in danger, then Y, you can eat on Yom Kippur. But they have now relinquished the right to weigh in on X. Right? They've said to the person asking, go ask your own doctor. That's one possibility. But there's another possibility, which is the rabbi says, no. My job is to figure out whether your life is in danger. So, I'm going to ask the doctor I trust. Or, I'm going to ask three doctors, and I'm going to take majority, just like would in halachic decision. Right? Now, I know this sounds crazy, but I know that Rabbi Willig has, I've heard Rabbi Willig say that ideally, the way he determines medical shailas is he asks several doctors and takes majority. And Rav Schechter has written that the job of the rabbi is to figure out halacha, but not to figure out facts. That's the job of the doctor, right? Now that's two very different ways of applying the halacha to reality. That's relatively easy, right? That's relatively easy. If you followed any of the COVID questions, you'll know that medical shailas get much more complicated than that because the line between fact and value is messy. And just to sort of illustrate how complicated this could get, let's say it's not medicine. Let's say it's politics, such as the land for peace dispute. Okay? Right? So when the poskim were arguing, can you trade land in Israel for peace, they first had to figure out the halachic question, which is, can you trade land in Israel to save lives? But the second question they had to figure out was, even if you say you can, who gets to figure out that this is life-saving? The rabbis? The politicians? The generals? The people who vote and whose lives are in danger? All of those were raised as possibilities, right? And they have very important repercussions. So, even let's say you have balanced your analysis of the primary sources, gathering however you think you should, what everybody who ever lived said about this before you. You figure out the custom, however you define that, that gets you as far as figuring out what, in theory, the halacha should be. But now you got to figure out what the reality is so that you can apply the halacha to that. And that has its own host of complications. But there's yet one more complexity, and that is, on the left side here, extenuating circumstances. Which is, there's a whole category in halacha which is called psikat halacha b'shat hadchak. That even though under normal circumstances, the job of a halachic authority is to follow the most plausible view, when there are extenuating circumstances, it's legitimate to follow the less plausible sources. Because the less plausible sources plus pressure equals justification to follow a possible, but maybe not as probable, halachic possibility. Now that sounds easy, except you need to figure out, well, what counts as an extenuating circumstance, and is this it? And in halacha, we have like 100 different factors that might or might not count. So, monetary loss, hefsed mamon. Monetary loss sometimes counts, but it's not clear how much of a monetary loss counts and whether that only works for biblical, for rabbinic law or even biblical law. That's a machloket. Kavod habriyo, right? Human dignity, which has become controversial in the ways it's been applied in certain women's issues. Chilul Hashem, which can sometimes lead to stringencies and sometimes to leniencies. Yuhara, which is religious presumptuousness or arrogance. As Yom HaTzmud is this week, religious Zionism as a factor in Psak. Right? Religious Zionist poskim sometimes think that the importance of having a state has to be factored into what decisions are employed in halachic decision-making. And obviously, the favorite every posek, which is the slippery slope argument, right? The slippery slope, which we invoke all the time, right? Which can lead to leniency, it can lead to stringency, it can lead to anything, right? So now, if you take all of that together, right, I think that you get what I would say in a nutshell is the complexity of psak, right? Is basically, you figure out what counts as the original sources and what do you think they mean. You look at the precedent. What did everybody before me say about this halachic question? You figure out what customs, what lived practice exists for this halacha. The posek takes these and weighs them in whatever way he thinks plausible and comes up with the most plausible psak. Then, if there are no extenuating circumstances, he then has to go through the complex process of applying theory to reality. And if there are extenuating circumstances, he has to figure out what are the extenuating circumstances and do they count for halachic purposes to justify relying on less plausible decisions, okay? Or less plausible possibilities. When you mix all of that together, right, then you get a practical decision, right? Then you've reached the end, right? Then you have a psak. But as should be very clear from just this sort of summary, the reason psak is so complicated, right? The halachic process is so complicated is because every one of these questions has sub-questions. The question of what sources count as primary, which sources count as secondary, how do I weigh their value? How do I figure out what I think the sources mean? Which customs matter? And how much weight do I give them? How do I determine reality? Who gets to determine reality? Is this a normal circumstance or is it an extenuating one? Who gets to choose and what do they do with that information, right? Every one of those questions has so much complexity wrapped up into it that when you just sort of take the bird's eye view, you realize why it is so important to sort of wade into the waters of halachic process. Because, you know, I feel like a lot of people you know, they ask a halachic question, or, and it sort of feels like magic, right? Like, you know, I know that my wife, when my wife is a yoetzet halacha, and she always, you know, one of the things that she feels is that a lot of people who've never really studied, you know, they think that nida questions are like magic. They go to the rabbi, they have no idea what the answer is going to be, right? And like, based on, they say one thing, it's mutter, another thing, it's usser. And like, no one has any idea why, right? And she tries very hard to explain what the factors are and why, depending on what you say, what answers are plausible and why they're plausible, because otherwise, right, it's very problematic if you just think of halacha as magic, right, as psak as magic, because then you feel, you're not engaged, right, you feel like the posek, whoever you turn to, they own halacha, and whatever they say, somehow, magically, they create a reality, when in fact, what they're doing is this artful balancing of a million different factors, meta factors, right? Before they even get to the local questions of your case, there's so many assumptions about what do they think halacha is. And by at least tasting it, right? At least wading into the waters, you realize that it's not magic. It's just a complicated conversation, right? With weighing a lot of factors, which all, as Malki said before, all have legitimacy, right? And the question of how much weight to give one to the other is, there is no right answer, right? Everyone is, every posek is somehow balancing these questions, but how and to what extent is complicated. And that's really, right? And that's what you need to realize when you talk about halacha, about halachic processes, about psak, right? Is that it's this conversation of so many factors over so many years, right? So many different types of traditions, written traditions and lived traditions that all somehow need to be brought in conversation to create, right, an answer that speaks to the reality in front of you. And that's really complicated. Okay. We'll see. I know we've already been 50 minutes. I'll see whether we have time to look at the sources that I put very quickly, but I'll take questions and comments now.
Question.
Yes, Malki.
If all of these sources, well, if all of them are legitimate, right? If all the stocks are legitimate from the different, let's say, Rebbeim, even in modern times, then I think a big question that I personally have is, if this rabbi says this, and that rabbi says this, and this rabbi says this, and they're all legitimate, how am I mean, and I don't mean this I don't mean this to be disrespectful, but which one is, I wouldn't say more credible, but how, as a layperson, do I look at these, all these different responses and say, well, you know what, this one speaks to me more than this one, and this one doesn't.
Okay, so...
You know, am I supposed to say this rabbi is the one that I follow and Zachal, that's it.
Okay, so there's a lot packed into Malki's question. So the first thing is, I would say the first thing we gotta put out there is that I think if you asked a given posek on a specific question, they are very unlikely to tell you that everybody's view has equal merit, right? Meaning, the whole point of this is that everybody in this conversation is trying to figure out the most plausible thing that God wants. And I don't know if it's fair to say that at least the postgame in the conversation actually believe that they're all equally right, right? I think that's the whole point, is that they may all be balancing the same types of factors, but I don't think any of them would tell you everyone is equally right. That everyone is in the same conversation, we hope. But they are trying to figure out who is the most right, right? Now, some people are more pluralist and are more likely to tell you, no, everyone's right. I just have to follow my truth, right? And other people will say, no, not everybody is right. There is one truth, right? And that could mean a lot of things. That could mean one truth, like up in heaven, or one truth here on earth, whether or not it reflects what might exist in heaven, right? So like Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks every posek has the truth as he sees it here, but it doesn't need to correspond to truth in heaven, right? In his introduction, he says the job of a posek is to figure out what he thinks is true, but it doesn't need to correspond to some ultimate truth, and it doesn't need to correspond to other people's truth. You have to follow yours, which is a pretty radical statement. Not everybody agrees with that, but that's how Rav Moshe takes it. But be that as it may, that's even at the level of the poskim. But what about the layperson? So this is not easy. And this really gets into one of the major questions, which has been brought to the fore in modern times, I think, more sharply, which is the balance between authority and autonomy, right? Where, you know, like 200 years ago, it was probably clear, you know, your rabbi was the rabbi in your town, you didn't communicate with other people and whatever. But now, where we're constantly in contact with the whole world, and we have a more educated laity, and autonomy is like an, you know, supreme value post Kant and Locke and people like that, people want input into the halachic process. So some people might tell you that's illegitimate, but honestly, there's so much in halacha that implies not that way, right? Because, right, halacha has aseh lecha rab, you make your own rabbi, right? But it doesn't tell you who has to be a rabbi. It's not necessarily the smartest person, right? The Rambam explicitly says your rav might know less than you, right? And that could be legitimate. So yeah, at some level, it might be the person you identify, but it's complicated, right? Every time you ask a shayla, in a certain sense, you're giving up your autonomy for the purpose of this question, but it's not obvious. This is a lot. There are a lot of questions that go into that. Like, you know, how many decisions, when can I decide for myself? And even if I don't decide for myself, can I have multiple poskim with integrity? Do I have to pick in advance which one? What types of questions I go to what type of person for? There's no easy answer to that. But I think it touches on all these issues of the balance of autonomy and authority and the role of the layperson in psak, which is, I think, more important than most people are often led to believe. I see a bunch of questions coming up on the chat. One second. Let me just see. Okay, I see, one second, three questions in the chat. Okay. So Jeff asks, can I shop around for the psak? So this is similar to Mindy's question, which is, can I shop around? Malki's question. So the answer is, shopping around the Gemara doesn't like. But does shopping around mean like I can't just look for a psak? What if I'm an educated layman and I pick a position not just because I like it, but because I think it's right, right? I wouldn't say that's shopping around, that's engaging in the halachic process. So shopping around just to find the answer you want is probably a problem. But if you're an educated layperson looking for the decision that you think makes the most sense, might not be. Or it might be, right? And it might depend on how complicated the shayla is and how qualified you are to decide. There are big black boxes on the screen. Okay, I'm sorry. I think that's where I have the Zoom, where I have people's faces up. Okay, I see Nussi is raising her hand. I think I see a virtual hand raise.
Now, with the structure of Jewish community the way it is today, many people will tell you that, well, my rabbi, my chosen. And as my rabbi once said, just because you have smicha doesn't make you a chosen. So where do we draw the line as to who is a recognized chosen, or who should the Jewish community at large recognize as a chosen? Because we have, you know, given, you know, what most people understand, that their rabbi is their chosen. We have a lot of poskim out there, and you know, and I'm sure you're going to have a divergence of opinion given any question. So what does the average person do?
Good. So there are several factors in your question, right? So let's try to tease them out. One is, what makes someone an authority for you? The second is, right, the second question you ask is, what makes them an authority recognized by the community? Those aren't the same, right? There are objective standards. So a certain baseline of knowledge, right? What that knowledge is, we'd have to talk about a certain baseline of knowledge. Two, the second factor is a proven ability to analyze sources. Now, how you know how much knowledge and whether they have that skill, that is complicated. At some level, smicha, even modern smicha, came to solve that problem originally, which was someone who themselves was a recognized authority said that this new person, you know, qualifies. That's essentially what smicha was, right? It was a heter hora. It was someone saying, you are qualified to paskin. But modern smicha doesn't always function that way. Correct. You are correct in that. But it's going to be a balance of knowledge, analytical abilities, and character, right? Meaning the Rimigash has a tshuva on this, where if you have someone who knows a lot but is a bad person, they don't get to be a posek because they don't have the integrity. That's the problem in all these things. The given was that the person asking said, should I ask this person who is smart but doesn't have integrity? So the decision had already been made, and the Rimigash said no. But you're right. The question of who decides is very hard. And one of the sort of meta questions, the macro questions that you'd have to ask here is, does halacha believe in an individualized, localized authority, which definitely much of halachic tradition does, or does it ideally believe in like the Gedolim and Das Torah, right? Which in the Haredi community is more along the lines of the way they think about halacha. Though honestly, not necessarily, right? Because, you know, in the Haredi world, on the one hand, you'll hear the Gedolim say, but the other hand, you'll hear like Hasidim say, I listen to my Rebbe. So there's sort of, right, there are these two intuitions, which is on the one hand, we're looking for the globalized recognized authorities, and then the idea that, no, maybe I have my own. It's the answer is it's complicated, right? There are different intuitions about what halachic authority looks like. And that's part of the question. And this, again, when I talked to Malki before, I said, you know, I wanted to do an introduction to get a feel for the types of questions people are interested in to plan the next few weeks, which is why I specifically wanted to sort of do the bird's eye view of Psak. But each and every one of these questions deserves a shear in and of itself because, yeah, what this overview highlights is that there are so many meta questions that affect the way we even think about how you ask questions, right? And that makes it complicated. Now, I see that we've already gone to an hour, and I think Malki had called it an hour. As Malki knows, I'm always happy to stay later, but I never want people to feel like I'm keeping them past the promised time. So we did our hour, so I will officially say we are done for the week, and you are, you know, free to go as much as you were ever not free to go. But I encourage all of you, either directly to me or through Malki, to like throw out the ideas of which questions came to you as we were doing this overview, so we can figure out what questions to study together over the next few weeks. Because like I said, I want to take this in the direction that you want to take it. Once we've seen the bird's eye view, I want you to answer, or I want you to ask, right? Ask yourselves, having thought about the bird's eye view, what bothers me, right? What questions are left that I want to study in depth and will help me understand and engage more, you know, and feel part of the halachic process myself more, right? What are the questions that will help me really understand what this system is and where I find my voice in it and my place in it, right? Like, that is the ultimate goal, is to, in the next 5 weeks, to delve into it and find our own places in the system and the process as much as possible. So I'll stick around, but I encourage you again, either through email or through Malki, to throw out the ideas, and, you know, I'll let Malki be the final arbiter, or we'll do it together, but throw out your ideas and we'll figure it out over the next few weeks. But thank you for coming and learning. It's been fun, and thank you for all of you who had the courage to ask questions. It made it a conversation, which is good. That's what I wanted. And I look forward to learning with you next week. Malki, do you want to make some announcements before we...
I was just going to end by saying again thank you to everybody. And I really will say that he means what he says when he encourages questions to him directly. even if it's something you don't want to ask on a class, he's excellent, thank God, at getting back to people very quickly. And I think that, again, the topic that he brings up is relevant in so many ways to so many of us in wherever we are holding, because I think that there's so many times where issues come up globally on a community or even personally, and confuses to why the process looks like it is and what we should be doing. Rabbi Ziering just put out his telephone number, which I guess would be his WhatsApp. So
yeah. If you want to, you can WhatsApp me as well through WhatsApp. That's the best way to do it. So you have my email, you have my WhatsApp. You can WhatsApp me. You can call me on WhatsApp. You can voice note me. Just remember the 7-hour time difference, and we're good. Right.
So we really appreciate you taking the time out.
Thank you so much. Have a good
luck.
Have a good week. Really appreciate
it. Shavua Tov to everyone. If you want to consult any question, which would be okay. Okay. Well, yeah. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Malki, thank you for arranging. This was fun, and we'll be in touch and figure out exactly what question. I know we talked about doing the source of rabbinic authority was something you'd raised. If you want to do that, we can do that next week. If you want to take up one of the questions that came up in the class, we can do that. So, whatever you want, I'm open.
And another question. I mean, I was speaking with my children over Shabbos, and I think one of the questions that came up was, when, won't say credibility, but many of the times, the kids, and they're younger, so they have a little different view on life and understanding of halacha, is they see a ruling with regard to, let's say, something modern. I guess I'll bring up either with regard to the women's or a more modern also of LGBT rulings, and they don't understand where some of it might be coming from in terms of why this rabbi would say this and why another rabbi who's also credible and would say something different in terms of that. And I think that those are questions that, you know, are fair to be asked, and certainly if there's a way to answer it in, you know, the most understanding way of where rabbis look to or come from with regard to some of those questions. And I think also, depending on the community that you belong to, where you're looking to find your answers, because I think that's also another issue. When you belong to a certain community, where are you looking for your answers?
Yeah, so, you know, so as with all these things, right, there's a lot of, like, sub-questions there, right? One is, you know, things that we talked about a little bit today, right, which is, what are the sources of authority? But part of that is also going to be, yeah, you know, implicit in a lot of these questions are a intuition that there are extenuating circumstances, right, especially in the women's issues, right? Kavod HaBriot gets thrown around as an extenuating circumstance, which justifies interpreting halacha in a not predetermined way, but preferring sources that will generate a certain type of answer, right? Let's say. So sometimes it means, right? So sometimes when people ask this question, what they mean is, Right? Sometimes being the local question, which is how do I generate a decision and figure out what's plausible? Sometimes they're really asking the second question, which is, let's say I recognize that this is a possible reading, but not necessarily the most plausible. How do I weigh the meta factors to figure out whether it's legitimate to follow, you know, the possible but not most plausible read, right? Meaning, and that's, right? And that's a dual question, right? One is the general legitimacy of psikat halacha b'sharat chak, of ruling differently in extenuating circumstances. And the second is, well, what counts as extenuating circumstances? The third type of question that you have to ask there is, specifically in the women's issues, since so much of the halacha itself is couched in sociological language, right? Like, kavod habriyah, right? Kavod hatzibur. This is not the honor of the community. So you need to figure out, how do we determine when sociological comments in halacha are objective comments that are true across time, and when might they not be, right? Might they be a description of the time of Chazal rather than a prescription, right? So those are three questions, sort of, that all intersect with, let's take the women's issues. The LGBT issues is even more complicated because, you know, it adds layers. Because sometimes you'll hear people saying, there is no plausible way of reading rabbinic tradition differently, but maybe rabbinic tradition is wrong, right? Which is a very sort of direct challenge. Sometimes people are saying, look, I don't need it to be mutter, I just need halacha to legitimate me turning the other way and letting these people be part of the community, right? And then it's really a question of, what are my responsibility to those who are violating halacha, right? Sometimes I mean the first, sometimes I mean the second, right? And sometimes I mean more than that.
That's another question. When you talk about violating halacha, is it violating halacha based on a rabbi who said something? Because again, we spoke about many, three different rabbis who were legitimate, have three different psakim. So when you say violating halacha, are you really violating halacha, or are you violating your rabbis versus some others? And we don't have to discuss this now because we're really going over time, but I think that those are the questions that I think we should...
Right, so the question, right, we need to, you know, I mean, just because we have a limited number of weeks, we do need to, right, we would just need to isolate which ones are the most important, you know, to study together. Because each of them is a lifetime, right? Meaning, you know, the LGBT ones, even if you just read the conservative series of Tshuvot, right, you know, which has a different starting point than Orthodox halacha, you'll see the range, right? Meaning, you don't even, this is not even just an Orthodox psak, right? But the conservative Tshuvot, which I think provide a wider range, not necessarily all things that I would accept, but to illustrate, you get everything from Gordon Tucker's "The conservative movement doesn't believe the Torah came from Sinai, so we can change the law through Takana," to Joel Roth, which is, there is no plausible way of reading rabbinic tradition that doesn't say that this is a biblical violation, to the conservative movement's accepted position, which was Nevins and Dorf, which was, the rabbinic violations can be overridden by Kavod Habriot, but not the biblical ones, right? Which is like a, right, sort of weaving in the middle, right? In Orthodoxy, you don't have all those possibilities, right? In Orthodoxy, for sure, the Gordon Tucker position is out, right? Which is, we don't believe Torah is Misinai, because obviously we do. Orthodox halacha is predicated on that notion, right? But, right? But, right, the range of what you can, depending on what, my point is that depending on your assumptions, right, you could go, right, you could end up in so many places, and you're right, that so much of this is less the local, right, it's how do you understand the system in its totality, such that what possibilities are even in the conversation, right, and that's what makes all these complicated, is there's always the local issue, but there's also the meta issue that determines what type of local possibilities even get into the conversation, right? And, you know, in each of these, there's just so many layers.
Okay, so over this next few days, well, you and I will go back and forth, and I'm hoping that some other people will weigh in and send you something as well. And if anyone has any questions now, or anyone who has any comments or anything...
Okay, I see Jeff said, if I want to consult one sword to educate myself concerning any question, what would it be? Do you mean any question, or you have a specific question in mind?
I felt in general, if I wanted to consult one source, general questions, okay? Can I turn on a light on Shabbat? You know, I mean, just get a simple question.
Simple, yeah, okay.
But you can answer that some other time. We don't have to take the time now.
The answer is there is no one place, right? Meaning what sources you look at really depend on so many, right? On so many factors. That, you know, that's the problem, is that, you know, the question, right? You know, everything we talked about today, right? If you ask certain poskim, they would say, well, if you don't start at the beginning, then you're not really understanding it. And other people will say, I don't care what it says in the beginning, right? Like Rav Asher Weiss in his Tshuva on Electricity says, look, you may not know why it's usur, but the lived practice of the Jewish people tells us that it's ilu bat kol yatsa min hashamayim, right? It's as if God himself said it's forbidden. Now we just got to figure out why, right? So you ask Rav Asher Weiss, he would say, you ask the Jew on the street. Once you know that it's usur, then you can figure out why. You ask him Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and he'll say, I don't really know why it's usur. And if you ask Rabbi Vinovich, he'll say, well, I don't know why it's usur, so, you know, it's not really always usur. Let's be honest, right? There is no one place to look, especially contemporary law. It's not like there's a code that you can even start with, right? You know, Rav Lichtenstein liked to point out that people think of the Mishnah Brura as like this ancient work, right? But it's really not. It was written in the 20th century, right? He died in 1936, right? And he's like the go-to source. But he never talks about electricity, even though it existed, right? Even though it was all around him, the Chafetz Chaim, who was arguably the most important posek of the 20th century, didn't address it once. He didn't bother addressing it, right? Because, like, that wasn't what he did. He wasn't a practical posek. He was a summary of the authorities on Shulchan Aruch. But if you can't look at, like, the arguably most authoritative source of the 20th century who lived with electricity to get an answer, then the answer might be, I don't know where you look. That's the problem, right? So it might mean that you got to go back to primary sources. It might mean that you got to look at consensus. It might mean you look at practice. I think the beauty of halacha is that there is no simple answers. The Rambam may have tried to make it simple in his time, but he failed miserably in getting everyone to agree that he should be the final word, right? Which is, you know, Moshe Halbertal traces this attempt and failure and what exactly the Rambam wanted to do in his short book on the Rambam. But it's actually telling, right? An analysis of what the Rambam thought he was doing and what he accomplished in doing is a good example of how hard it is to create a unified halachic tradition. So the answer might be there is none, and maybe that's a good thing if you ask Shlomo Luria, and maybe it's a bad thing if you ask the Rambam. So I can't give you a simple answer there. But okay, we're 15 minutes over and I feel like I'm keeping people. So I'm going to let everyone go. Malki, we'll be in touch. And thank you for arranging and a group that was actually into...
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing a group that was open to discussing, because, you know, this will make it more fun, but also more challenging to figure out what to do each week. But that's good.
People are going to discuss, because I think that the group that's on is very interested in certain